Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition, a quote-unquote blog. This episode is sponsored by Jamf and Linode. All right, Daniel. Well, some news that I think caught both of our attention was this 1Password rumor. And this was, I think, first reported by BGR.com, Boy Genius Report. And it was an exclusive about Apple deploying 1Password to all 123,000 employees. Plus a little added bonus that maybe Apple's going to acquire 1Password.
Yeah, right.
Which is both of those alone would be huge.
Either a little, right. And then shortly afterwards, I hastened to add 1Password's Twitter account tweeted, "Rumors of my acquisition are completely false. My humans and I are happily independent and plan to remain so." And I just thought, like, well, that just confirms that Apple bought them and already owns them, because they're denying things they're already about to do.
Well, this is a pretty clear tweet. It's not like a "we have no comment" or "don't believe the rumors." No. And of course, this is a little bit of a side rant, but I think it's hilarious that the first reply on that thread is, yeah, but what about dark mode? It's like this is like classic Twitter. Like, you say something and then someone replies with something completely unrelated that they're annoyed by.
Right. Something that they're just, while I have your attention. Yeah, they could have said, "how about dark mode" to at 1Password anytime over the past however long they've been, you know, hoping for it. And they just like, "yeah, but." I get similar stuff to that. Like, as you can imagine, I get similar stuff like, "hey, yay, Mars Edit 4. Yeah, what about iPad?" You know, it's like, okay.
So let's discard the acquisition rumor, because I don't believe it, and focus on the ginormous site license.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't reveal, I think, in this report, like, what the deal actually would be. But, you know, we know that 1Password is a really successful company. Like, I am just kind of blown away that they actually have, I think, almost 100 people, somewhere around that, in terms of employees, full-time, you know, working remotely. But that's a really successful company, and they've done a great job of transitioning to, like, monthly subscription pricing. And so you can go look, and it's like, whatever, it's like $3 a month for families per user. They have business plans, $8 a month. But then they also have, you know, if you're a big enterprise, contact us, and we'll work out a deal, which is, I assume, what this falls under. But even if Apple's paying even just a small amount per user, this is a really big sale.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's the lowest? Here's a good thought experiment. What's the lowest price per user per year that 1Password could accept from Apple and have this still be good news? It's arguable that $0 per user per year is still a good deal for 1Password. Not the greatest business deal, maybe, but, you know, like, it's so valuable to have Apple, the host platform for your most important, you know, the company that owns the most important platforms that your software runs on, to have them go all in on it with their own employees. It's a pretty good in with Apple. You know, a lot of us are trying to just get Apple's attention in the slightest way, to fix bugs we report, or, you know, maybe feature us in the App Store, or, you know, give us a new enhancement to the APIs that will make developing our apps easier. And you gotta expect that if somebody at 1Password wants to get somebody at Apple on the phone, it will happen. You know, like, this is a good relationship for 1Password.
Yes, but I don't think $0.
No, I'm just going to the extremes. Yeah. But, you know, just to say, like, it's not good business sense for it to be $0. And it's not good business sense, for that matter, for it to be $0 for Apple, probably, either. They want to help sustain this company that they've obviously, if this is true, I don't think we've seen any confirmation from Apple that even the 100,000 employees being licensed to use it is true. But let's take a more, so, like, going from that zero up to, like, $1 per user per year
That's a pretty sweet, you know, over $1 million of extra revenue per year for the company.
No, $100,000 per.
I'm saying per year.
Yeah. No, I was saying $1 per year, not $1.
Oh, $1 per year.
Yeah, let's just say, like, because, you know, making it like, $1 per year is still probably on the not enough end of the scale, but it starts to be like roughly enough to sustain like one at least entry, you know, junior level software developer at 1Password who can work on features. You know?
Yeah, I thought you said $1 a month, which is kind of, I was thinking at first, like 25 cents to $1 a month or something like that. Because just to keep that kind of monthly math, I think this is an interesting deal because I think it does have to be non-zero, but obviously it's way less than the normal business plan at $8 a month. I mean, I don't think there's any way Apple would pay that kind of full price for so many people. But it does have to be not zero. So, like, to back up a little bit, for a long time, Apple has had a thing where they encourage third-party developers to offer their software to employees for free.
Or at a discount. There's a sort of one single program that you can present stuff to Apple employees at a discount or free. Yeah.
Right. And so I, back when I was doing more traditional selling Mac software one-off before micro.blog, I participated in that, and I gave everybody with an apple.com email address a free copy. And it's different than this, though, because of the 100,000 employees, very small percentage need like my video management app, ClipStart, or my old app, you know, WeTransfer for video game related stuff. Like, it was a very small percentage of people. I'm happy to give everybody a copy, and then maybe, you know, maybe they'll tell someone about it, you know, if they work in a retail store or, you know, and just good word of mouth, like, could happen from that. But this is different because everybody has passwords. And so it's not crazy to think that a huge percentage of the 100,000 people will actually use 1Password. And so it's a very different kind of support burden than just a handful of Apple employees here and there.
In fact, it's reasonable to assume, if this rumor is true, I would expect that part of the reason it's true is because Apple has an internal security program going that they want every single one of their employees who has a work-related password, which I would suggest is probably every single internal employee. One way or the other, probably has some Apple ID, for example, that they use to log in to something. And I think that I think that must be the case, regardless of how technical your job is at Apple. I would expect that there is some Apple password access to some internal Apple stuff that has a password. So I would expect that if this rumor is true, it's not just an offer to all 123,000 employees, but it's a demand. You know? So, I mean, this is why this is an interesting rumor on a lot of levels, because it indicates, for one thing, it indicates that, I mean, it's a little problematic if you care about Apple's own keychain stuff, because it sort of indicates that they don't consider their own keychain support sufficient for their employees' own needs.
Right. It is a little strange in that regard, and why the acquisition part of this is kind of a logical next step, because, if they don't think the keychain's good enough, then maybe they just need to get 1Password and give it to all users. Because, I mean, if take any other Apple app, like, let's take Safari. If Apple licensed Firefox somehow, I don't know if it was a commercial app, to all their employees to use instead of Safari, I mean, that would be really bizarre, but that's essentially what's happening here. So, I mean, maybe there's some features in 1Password in terms of managing teams, and, you know, kind of enterprise level features and syncing that Keychain just doesn't try to do. And so maybe Apple is okay with saying, you know, 1Password is actually much, much better for companies and teams. We still love Keychain for individuals. And we're going to keep pushing that for individuals. But 1Password is so good for teams. Like, yes, we're going to use it. And that's okay. We're okay with having those two kind of similar products next to each other.
Yeah, I think there's no way that this, if this is true, and they're imposing slash allowing slash, you know, I love 1Password. So just to be clear, I'm not like saying, I'm using imposing very clinically here, but just, if it's true that they're imposing this on all their employees, then it means at least for some subset of password management tasks, their own employees are going to be using this instead of the keychain. And let's be real, like anybody who gets into a habit of using 1Password at Apple because they're required to for some work-related stuff, I sort of highly doubt that they're going to prioritize using Apple keychain stuff, even in their personal life.
Right.
It's going to be like an onboarding to using 1Password everywhere. And it's a serious, serious problem, I think, when every single one of your employees is incentivized not to use a critical central piece of your own company's security infrastructure.
Yep, I agree. You know, it's like last week we talked about that I moved my blog to Microdot Blog Hosting, and we use Microdot Blog Hosting for things like our Micro Monday podcasts. Like, you know, it's like we use our own platform for hosting the audio files and everything. It'd be kind of like me saying, yeah, Microdot Blog Hosting is great, but everybody that works at Microdot Blog needs to use WordPress. Like, that, it's the same kind of thing. What kind of message does that send?
Right.
And if that's true, is the core product getting better, or is the third party, you know, complement to the product getting better?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of examples of this. You know, there's a reason, for example, that after Apple came out with the iPhone and iPad, that all the Apple stores switched away from the point of sale terminal stuff that they had, which was, you know, field tested, had already been, this is a product that already exists, but it would quickly make zero sense for Apple to be using something other than an iPad for their like in-house stuff. And it's like, it was enough of an obvious move that they probably even had to develop custom software to make that situation work. So I find this all very, very interesting. The fact that 1Password outright denied that they're being acquired while not saying anything about the site license, I don't know what that means. It could mean that they just prefer to, it could mean that there's no site license and they just prefer to let that rumor linger, because let's face it, it's good PR if there's a rumor that Apple's going to site license your software to every single employee. Like, I don't know if I'd go out of my way to say, no, it's not true. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. This gets back to something we were talking about last week with the question of honesty and framing PR. You know, is it, if somebody says, I heard that Apple's licensing Mars Edit to every single one of their employees. I'm such a kind of like forthcoming person. I probably would just say, no, that's not true. I wish. Right. But there's probably a business rationale for just saying I can neither confirm nor deny.
Right. And so, I mean, I don't know. Could be too that the person that wrote that tweet, yeah, they wanted to stick to what they knew, and there may or may not be ongoing discussions about a site license. I think that the source for this article, while it's clearly not 100% correct and there's some speculation in there, I think the source is someone in that 100% AgileBits company, because it says, you know, AgileBits annual revenue is said to be around $5 million to $10 million range, which, as an aside, congratulations to them again. I'm really impressed with how successful they are. And so that's whoever kind of leaked this information seems like it's on the 1Password side. So I would think that this rumor, except the acquisition part, is completely true. I think they probably are thinking or talking about a site license.
And I'm kind of glancing at the article as we talk, and it looks like the entirety of the Apple acquisition of AgileBits, part of the rumor, is based on a single reference to somebody overhearing Jeff Shiner, the CEO of AgileBits, talking about, quote, the Apple acquisition in the glass conference room of the company's office. It could have been any of Apple's right. acquisitions.
It could have been anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it could have been like, oh, what do you think about the new, such and such yeah. that Apple's doing? So that's just, I think that there's a pretty good, I would say, I cry foul a little bit on the, the interpretation of this article. They put it in the headline, acquisition talks underway. That's just, this is an example of bad, that's bad journalism.
Yep, agreed.
And so it's very interesting if the source for the site licensing is more concrete and more, justifiable to interpret this as true. But the acquisition stuff can just, I think like what you said is true, Manton, that the acquisition stuff mostly comes as fallout of like, if Apple were to do this, then why wouldn't they want to acquire?
Right. That could be exactly what the employee overheard is yep. like them, the leaders at AgileBits speculating exactly like we are, but that doesn't mean that there's actually any talks underway. I agree. This headline is extremely misleading and, I love the article because I think this is really fascinating, but yeah. they probably should have dropped the certainty yes. of the acquisition part.
That's classic clickbait, I think. But anyway, I don't know. In summary, I think, like I said, I think this is bad news for Keychain if it's true. And I don't see how Apple can meaningfully continue to put a great deal of effort into making the Keychain experience as good as it can be. If they're investing all of their personal, experience into a third-party product. All right, we're glad to have back this week our friends at Linode. If you need a Linux box to host a website, a private Git repository, or to serve as the backend for your iOS app, consider Linode Cloud Hosting. With Linode, you can get a server running in under a minute. They've been doing infrastructure as a service since 2003, and their plans start at the 1 gigabyte level for only $5 a month. Linode's 10 global data centers are equipped with industry-leading data center-grade SSDs, and their plans range from that low $5 a month plan up to higher memory plans that start at 16 gigabytes. All of these plans come with the full control you expect from a VM. They support Docker containers, encrypted disks, VPNs, etc. And they offer 24/7 friendly support. They're even open on holidays. So they actually also have a special $20 credit. And if you think about it, that $20 credit is good for 4 free months at the $5 a month entry-level plan. So I think if you haven't done it already, listen, this is a great opportunity to check out what Linode has to offer. Use the promo code CoreInt2018 or just go to linode.com/CoreInt and you'll get all set up with your promo code and get to check out what everybody's been raving about with Linode. Thanks so much to Linode for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, as I talk about all the time on the show, I've been using Linode for years now for all my micro.blog servers. I'm really happy with them. Runs really smoothly, but of course, sometimes I make a mistake. And actually, recently, last week, I kind of ran out of disk space on one of my servers, even though I have plenty of disk space for this particular server. I forgot about a log file that was just accumulating, like 100 gigabytes or something. This log file was just getting really big. And why do I mention that? Because these kind of problems are really well addressed in Linode's excellent documentation. If you go to their website and you go to the guides and tutorials section, there's a whole guide just on using the log rotate command to solve these kind of problems. So you can roll your logs over, you can archive them or delete old ones, and it's extremely detailed and very well written. And they have guides like this for many, many things you might run into if you're running your own server. Possibly you're running a server, you never run into these kind of things. But if you do, I love that they have this great documentation. Thanks so much to Linode for sponsoring the show. And again, go to linode.com/CoreInt.
So Manton, I didn't make it out to WWDC, as you know, and as our listeners mostly know. But one of the things that I noticed was people were raving. One of the things that, like, if you had to, like, make an icon for the attendee experience at WWDC San Jose 2018, I think it might be a scooter because everybody seems to want to talk about their experience either seeing the scooters, riding the scooters, bemoaning the scooters, being irritated by them getting in the way. There's this thing that has hit the United States this year. I think they started last year, but it seems to be really ramping up this year. This whole idea of scooter share, basically the same idea as a bike share, where, you know, increasingly around the world, you have opportunities to use a smartphone app, usually to unlock access to a bicycle that you can borrow and then leave and pay a small fee. And now we got these scooters. I know you have, I think you have Lime scooters in Austin.
Yep.
And the Lime and Bird scooters
were... We have Bird too. Yeah, we have a
You have Bird too. Okay. Yeah. So they were both in San Jose as well. We don't have any of the scooters, as far as I know, here in Boston yet. But my own hometown, Arlington, Massachusetts, just got the Lime bicycles. And these differ from what a lot of folks are used to, I think, all over the world. For, you know, for the past 10 years or so, there's been an increasing number of these docked bicycles where you basically pick up a bike, you use a smartphone or credit card or whatever to unlock a bike from a docking station, and then you drive it around, and then you put it back into another docking station. And the real innovation with these like Lime and Bird type things, in my opinion, is that there's no docks. And that's a real liberating, freeing thing for consumers, and kind of raises some social problems with the, I think a lot of the criticisms of these things is the extent to which they may get left around or abused by random, you know, people. And it's just kind of an interesting social and technological thing that's happening that is one of these, yet another one of these things that I think is enabled by the existence of smartphone technology, solar panels, and GPS. Mm-hmm. GPS and probably these things are hooking up to the bicycles, the scooters themselves are hooking up to cell phone networks, I'm guessing.
Yeah, the technology is making this happen. As you said, it's just like an explosion right now. In Austin, so we have at least the two scooters. Lime, you know, you have the bikes. We don't have the bikes yet. I'd love to have them. If you download the app, even if you don't ever use it, you can download the app and you can just like zoom in on different cities. And it's really fascinating to see which cities in the country have the scooters, the bikes. Also, some cities have electric bikes, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yep. If you have a big commute and you don't want to have to pedal quite as hard, I think that's really cool. So in Austin for a few years now, we've had the bikes that are like you said, there's stations, you know, scattered around the city, and you check them out there and you put them back at a different station. The one we have is called B-Cycle, and they have a bunch of other cities in the country, but not everywhere. And it says it's a nonprofit, and so I assume that they have some deal with the city that they rolled these out again, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And my guess is that because that's like the official bike sharing, that that's maybe held up some of these other new startups coming in with their thousands of bikes and littering the city. But I don't actually know. It could be a more of a strategic thing where Lime is, they know which cities need bikes versus scooters, and so they're kind of rolling it out that way.
Well, it just seems like a full court press, so to speak. You like that, Manton? I'm a super basketball fan.
All right.
It's a full court press on this new, like, on bike sharing and scooter sharing right now. And it's caught the attention of Uber and Lyft, who seems like they kind of got caught like unaware that this was going to be a thing, because these like Lime and Bird, and we got other ones here. Ofo, I think, is one. They're all over the country, all over the world. There are these new, like, you know, these non-docked shared vehicles. But it sounds like Lyft and Uber are sort of trying to play catch up pretty quick, because like a couple things I think just this past month or so happened. One is Uber actually invested in Lime. That's one way to, you know, if somebody else just like totally beats you at your own game, one way to catch up is just to invest in their company.
Yeah.
The other thing is Lyft acquired the company, it's called Motivate, that I think sort of administers a lot of the technology for these bike sharing, with the docked bike sharing programs in particular. So I just kind of feel like this was already gaining momentum, and now to have Uber and Lyft getting involved, it feels like we're just down the precipice of a lot of growth in this area. And it's pretty inspiring. Like I mentioned that there are problems with the, you know, the sort of like leave anywhere bicycles and scooters, and people get annoyed because somebody might leave it on your lawn or something, and people get annoyed. There's good like accessibility issues that people raise with like people leaving bikes in the middle of sidewalks that somebody in a wheelchair couldn't easily, you know, get around then. But what's really inspiring to me is I'm going around my little town here and I'm seeing people ride these things, and they don't look to me, just judging them by the looks of it, they don't look to me like somebody who's like been riding their bike every day and then just decided to ride these things instead. These are people who look like they haven't ridden a bike in 20 years. And they're like, well, I guess this is my opportunity. And it's pretty cool. It's like a nice thing to see. And, you know, you wish you had the bikes. I wish I had the scooters. So, you know, we need to get some more growth here. Because like, there's definitely some people who would always choose the bikes, and some people who would at least sometimes choose the scooters instead.
Right. And there's different use cases, because like I would choose the bikes because, so for, to be clear, first of all, we live kind of in the suburbs. Like none of these are useful to us. Like everybody has a car in our neighborhood. Everybody drives. If people are out biking, if people are out biking in the neighborhood all the time, it's because they own a bike and they're just biking for fun. So in the city, more downtown, is where you have all this stuff. If I'm going downtown to work or something, I don't really need one of these scooters, but I guess I could use one to zip around. More likely, I want to use one of these bikes because I'm somewhere else in Austin in a park or by the river or something, and I just want to bike around just for fun, right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily to get to my office or to get to my, you know, something work-related. So different use cases, and you really, I think you do kind of need both scooters and bikes to cover everything, plus ride-sharing and Lyft and everything. And of course, there's a difference. On the one hand, it makes sense that Lyft and Uber are interested in these because, yeah, like you said, it's all powered by GPS and apps, and that's what's unlocking all the potential for this. And it's very similar, the Lyft app versus the Lime app. But on the other hand, the business is very different because with the ride sharing, there's much less investment in like cars because people bring their own car most of the time. And you can kind of like tap into all these people that want to have a job that is really flexible. They can just want to drive for a few hours on the weekend, or they want to make it almost more of a full-time thing. And with the bikes and the scooters, these companies need significant amount of money, like a traditional startup, to buy all these bikes and deploy them. So it's very different, like startup costs, I think. But then once you get rolling, I think it's a similar business. Yeah. I kind of go back to, think about something that's really works really well today that didn't work in the old dot-com days, like year 2000 kind of, is like something like grocery delivery. In the old days, you know, I can't even remember the grocery delivery companies, like Peapod was one, but there's another one, forgot. But anyway, there's a couple of these grocery delivery companies where you go on the website, you order your groceries, and they would deliver them. But they had to invest in like the delivery van and full-time employees. And those companies pretty much all failed. Like they couldn't, they couldn't get profitable. Fast forward to now, it works completely differently. You want to do grocery delivery. Someone has an app and they get called to do a run of groceries. Someone's in the store shopping. They use their own car to deliver groceries to you. And so that those initial costs, they don't need to buy vans for everybody. People use their own cars. And so that seems profitable and here to stay. And so the reason I'm comparing this is ride sharing, obviously here to stay. Bike sharing and scooter sharing, probably here to stay. But again, I assume that there's a huge cost to deploying these. And I assume that these companies aren't even close to being profitable in any way for a while.
Well, it's an interesting situation because we also know that Lyft and Uber and like every other ride sharing company probably is also working on self-driving technology.
Right.
They've been like actively trying to get the driver out of the equation. And I think you're right. that what comes with that, if they succeed in that, suddenly they're on the hook for the car. You know, they're not going to get people like donating their self-driving cars. Well, right. Yeah, what do I do for a living? I just bought a $30,000 self-driving car and I just let Uber use it.
Yeah.
And, so it's kind of I can see this kind of focus on scooters and bikes as a very low cost way to sort of like pilot some of the ideas that, because if you think about it from Uber and Lyft and anybody else's point of view, a consumer-driven vehicle is the same as a self-driven vehicle because there's no employee relationship. Mm-hmm. It's all pure consumer-oriented. So the fact that a consumer finds a bike, gets on it and pedals it and steers it, it's exactly the same mechanics as a self-driving vehicle as far as the company is concerned. The self-driving vehicles will be things that people, I guess, you know, the only difference is a self-driving vehicle, you could presumably summon it to come get you. But the fact is there's no additional cost than to the maintenance and, you know, investment in the vehicle itself. So these, you know, you're right. It's like this significant upfront cost to have these powered scooters, powered bikes, sometimes pedal bikes. But from a like fleet management point of view, it's just like this massively cheaper thing to do than, and not to mention technologically possible thing to do than self-driving cars. But the company that learns the most at this phase, I think, will be best positioned when it comes to self-driving car time. They'll just be like, okay, we know a lot. And imagine just for example, if you were trying to go from, you know, paying Uber drivers to self-driving cars without any interim experience, like what they're gaining from this.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're getting a lot of experience with how you like make the, you know, just make the whole like, cause even if you get into a self-driving car and it's all automated, there's still things you got to know about how it's done. How do you hail it? How do you unlock it or whatever? Right. You come across a car that's a self-driving car that's part of the Lime network, let's say, they're going to know things about, you know, how to represent that on your app, how you unlock it. Like there's interesting things the bikes do. Like they make a little noise if you unlock it successfully. Mm-hmm. And you can even like have a little noise that it will like attract your attention to the right one.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
I don't know. It's kind of interesting. I can see this as being for somebody who has a long view in providing navigation, you know, transportation rather, to end users, that investing in this is maybe sort of pays for itself in the expertise you gain.
Mm-hmm. A related kind of company to this is like the Car2Go, and there's more mm-hmm. than just them, but I think of them because they've been in Austin for a while. Is where it's similar to your self-driving example, where you find one of the cars, you walk up to it, you unlock it, and then you drive. Of course, you have to drive yourself because they're not self-driving. The long view, like when you think about summoning a car and the self-driving, long view is the right way to frame that because this isn't going to happen anytime soon. Like, this is so many years off. Like, I can't even guess how many years it's going to be until you could summon a car to come get you. I just think this is way, way off. So it makes a lot of sense for, like, bike sharing and scooter sharing is not years off. It's now. So they should definitely invest in this and experiment with it. And I think it's useful today. Ride sharing, I mean, self-driving car ride sharing is just so far off that, let's focus on what problems we can solve now. And the bike sharing and the scooter sharing is actually solving some problems right now.
Yeah, I think it's pretty, it's impressive. And I think, you know, in my own town, we have a kind of mix of like really, you know, liberal thinking, like this is a good thing. Anything that gets more people out of cars, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have our fair share of the conservative thinking, like, damn it, they just get in the way and everybody should drive anyway. It's kind of frustrating, but I think it's one of these things that's going to get normalized, and we're going to think of it as just, of course, you have bikes around that anybody can ride, and scooters around, and I really do think it's going to help a lot of people. Like for me, it's mostly a novelty because I don't have to like get to work, and you know, I don't know. It's kind of a novelty, but I think some people are already starting to use these to save money and to get to maybe get to jobs that they couldn't get to otherwise. And when you look at it that way and the social benefit, it's really cool to see it happening. All right, folks, this week we are glad to welcome back Jamf Now. Jamf Now makes it easy to set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices. It's easy to keep track of your own Mac, iPad, or iPhone, but what about the other Apple devices at work? As a business grows, so does its digital inventory, making it exponentially harder to manage everyone's Apple devices. This is especially true if employees are remote. With Jamf Now, you can check your digital inventory, distribute Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy apps, protect company data, and even lock or wipe a device as needed from anywhere. Jamf Now manages devices, so you can focus on your business instead. No IT experience needed. Core Intuition listeners, start securing your business today, setting up your first three devices for free, forever. Add more, and it's just $2 a month per device. Create your free account today at jamf.com/coreint. That's jamf.com/coreint. Thanks to Jamf Now for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, it's great to have Jamf Now sponsoring the show. You know, I was using Jamf Now and kind of playing around with the interface, and you can just tell when a company does a great job of taking something that could be complicated, like how do you configure a product like this to send out configurations and apps and different things to all these devices. They take that and they break it down into a few steps, walk you through setting it up, and then they have a great interface for configuring what you want to put on these devices. So they have this concept of blueprints where you can say, this represents the things I want to push the devices. Like maybe I have these two or three apps that I want to go to the devices, even have like web clips, so, you know, like websites that are going to have icons on the home screen that you can tap on and take you places. So you can have all this configuration stuff, all the apps that you want on the devices in this blueprint and then send it out. Does a great job, again, of walking you through setting this up. It's free to get started, and it's affordable if you have a bunch of devices that you need to add. If they're your own devices, like in a small company, or you're more of an enterprise customer with tons of devices, or an educational institution with a bunch of Macs or iOS devices, and you need to push all of this stuff out to them. Definitely check it out. You can learn more at jamfnow.com/coreint. That's jamf.com/coreint. It's free to get started. You can learn more there. Thanks so much to Jamf Now for sponsoring the show. So Daniel, as we're recording on the MicroDotBlog side of things, we're trying to wrap up Sunlit, new version of Sunlit, which kind of embraces an Instagram-like feel of having a photos-only timeline. Maybe it'll be out by the time this posts. Probably not. But anyway, one of the things I've been thinking about with this release is I want it to actually have an impact. Like, I want people to notice, because I think that's a really great release that pushes the idea of what MicroDotBlog can be even further into photos and, you know, people that care about photo blogs, but also people that just love Instagram, but they're annoyed by it because it's owned by Facebook and because of the timeline and just decisions that Facebook has made since the acquisition. So I like this release a lot, and I want a lot of people to see it. The question is, how do I get a lot of people to see it? You know, and it's just your classic marketing question, but I've been thinking about this because every once in a while I have something that I do want to have a big reach. And, famously a handful of years ago, basically, reset all my Twitter stuff. And so I don't have a lot of followers on the cross post for my blog to Twitter. So that doesn't reach a lot of people unless people with tons of followers retweet everything I do, which I can't count on. There's also, of course, press people picking it up and writing about it. That would be great. And then there's actual marketing and advertising where you actually pay to have something on another site. So trying to balance all this and figure out the best way to get the word out, it's a constant challenge, but I'm particularly feeling it right now because I feel like this release could have a big impact. But how do I get from, we're wrapping up the beta to thousands and thousands and thousands of people know about this release?
paging Gene McDonald. we right. need you, Gene.
Yeah.
No, that's it's kind of a funny. I imagine you being like, Gene, can you help me out? I want to reach like thousands and thousands of people, but can't use Twitter. Well, you know, or something. You know?
And she, I mean, she's given whole talks about like reaching people with podcasts, which is great if you have a budget to sponsor a bunch of podcasts. And so that's the other challenge. Yeah. Like if I had a bunch of, you know, advertising money, then the problem becomes a little bit easier because I would sponsor like 10 podcasts and maybe pick 5 or 10 blogs to sponsor, but not so easy.
I have a couple ideas. Well, I mean, this kind of gets back at what we were talking about a few weeks ago, and then intermittently since then, it's like this whole idea of us trying to like open up our minds to maybe some more niche marketing opportunities. You know, that's advertising, and then there's marketing.
Right.
And marketing, as you know, is anything you can do to get people to basically know about your product. That's basically marketing, I think. I mean, maybe somebody can correct me, but that's my understanding of it. You know, there's a classic distinction between marketing and sales. Sales is trying to get somebody to buy your product, and marketing is trying to get somebody to know about your product.
Right.
And it's obviously not enough for somebody to know about your product, but it sure helps. And this kind of also gets back to that fun, to that funny metaphor we had of like micro.blog as the shack in the outskirts of town, yeah. So down a dirt road, and you have to know the secret exit to get off at.
Yep.
I don't know. I think that with a personal content publishing app like Sunlit, I can relate to it because that's effectively what Mars Edit is.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been very grateful for the fact that of all the apps in the world, some of the best self-marketing apps, I think, are these kinds of apps where people use them in themselves to communicate with the world, right? If you want viral marketing, try to get users who are buying your app because they want to communicate with as many people as possible. And that's not strictly true for every one of your customers or every one of my customers. Some people are very conscientiously writing blogs that are for a private audience or that they legitimately don't want a large audience.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, fact is a lot of people are excited when they share a Sunlit, you know, photo story, photo sequence, and they find out that, you know, 100 different people have looked at it. That would be exciting. And so I think one angle to go at is how do you tastefully get people excited about sharing the fact that they are doing what they're doing with your app?
A lot of companies are like, they plan for viral marketing and this kind of thing, and they build it into the product. And I don't like doing those kind of things usually. I kind of err on the side of not doing that kind of stuff because I think it can be really tacky.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of, you know, the that kind of stuff that would naturally spread on a social network, I kind of shy away from. But there are some things like that, though. I mean, like if you have a hosted blog on micro.blog, there is by default a link to like your micro.blog profile, for example, and someone can click on that and discover what micro.blog is about. So there's some kind of stuff like that, but it's done, I think, pretty subdued, pretty tastefully. And so, yeah, finding the right version of that for Sunlit is really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that too much yet.
Yeah, I've often thought, you know, I've often toyed also with the idea of like, you know, should like posts that are made with Mars Edit have like a little posted with Mars Edit thing?
And
I think the answer is obviously no,
right?
Because it's too much. It's too, to be on every post would be scammy feeling.
Yeah.
And I think it works better for something like WordPress, or you could do this with the micro.blog too, where you have control of the whole site. And so, like, it's very common on WordPress sites to see a little proudly powered by WordPress tag on the bottom of the site.
Yeah.
And that's something that's in there by default and that you can easily take out.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's even, so I have a link to, basically, like, the theme I'm using in micro.blog, it says, like, also on micro.blog, and you click on it and it goes to my profile. And that's it. I think even the proudly powered by, to be honest, is too much. What if they're not proud? Like, I feel like that's really...
It's a little bit, yeah, projecting onto the user.
I think it really is. But you're right. It's not too bad. WordPress has been doing that for a while. People are used to it. And then the other extreme on that, it's interesting what we get used to that actually is not really okay. So like Medium, if you have a quote unquote blog on Medium, and it's
a quote unquote blog,
that's another discussion about whether it's actually a blog, because now that you can't have your own domain name, I'd argue it's almost not really a blog at all. But anyway, if you go to someone's quote unquote blog on Medium, you get tons of like sign in with Medium, you know, get started about Medium memberships. There's a big header that says Medium, like Medium, Medium, Medium. I don't like that because it's all about the platform, not about the person, right? So I don't want to do that kind of stuff. But it's interesting that we're used to that. We're used to that on Twitter. It's just a given. You go to someone's Twitter profile to see their tweets and you get a bunch of stuff about joining Twitter. And we're used to that, but I don't want to go that far with the stuff that I'm doing. I want it to be a little more tasteful than that, because at the end of the day, the goal is to empower people to write on their own site, and it's about them. It's not about me.
I had a thought cross my mind. You know, last week we talked about the sort of nostalgia for web rings and stuff, right? Like, and maybe it's too much for micro.blog to be like automatically putting people into like a web ring, or to automatically join people in the indie web ring. But maybe there's some angle on that that helps turn sunlit posts in particular into a kind of into a kind of a virtuous circuit. You know, a great just like way of expressing it for sunlit in particular is like this blog is sunlit. You know, it's a great little phrase. And you could have a little like, you know, sun rays icon or something. And it's kind of funny because it's kind of like a little bit of a play on like this party is lit or something, you know, it's a little bit slangy. And I don't know, I could see there being something where it would add to the viral marketing aspect of your service if a very specific kind of micro.blog post included links to other micro.blog posts of the same ilk. And it's like, oh, this is one of the, this is, a, it's kind of like, you know, a way of, it's similar to your use of the emoji for themed things like football or books or whatever. And so there could be like a kind of like, I don't know, just thinking out loud here, but like one of the distinguishing characteristics of micro.blog might be to not only to take that concept, your sort of replacement concept for hashtags, and add a feature that allows you to sort of like navigate hashtagged, pseudo hashtagged posts through a kind of web ring interface.
Yeah, that's
like
interesting.
You just say like, you know, this post, you could even just say this post is sunlit, and have a little like next and previous buttons that take you to a random other sunlit post.
And so we have kind of related to that. We have a photos section in the Discover, which is, you know, photo, it's curated, but it's photos, you know, that people post with sunlit or something else. And so it could tie into that. And it actually, maybe we should just do a better job of kind of showing people that, right? So it's like right now you kind of have to click around. It's kind of buried, but maybe it's like, if you go to sunlit.io, maybe it should just show you like a grid of like a bunch of gray photos or something, you know, like a better job of like showcasing that stuff might help.
Yeah. I think there's something to that. I mean, just the idea of having, you know, I think this idea is coming from, how do you make the fact that somebody, one of your users, successfully shared their content with your app, how do you make it more obvious to people who view that content that the tool is open for their use as well? Because like, if I just have a completely, like, if I use a tool to help publish to my own domain and make my own content available to my readers, that's great. But I might be willing to let my readers know that the same kind of power is available to them. And for any of your users who are willing to do that, then that would help you in your viral marketing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is all good. Of course, it's not exactly the question I asked, which is like, I want to have a big launch day. You know, it's like, there's a different kind of angles, but it's...
Okay, I have one more quick idea for you then. So erase all that. Forget that. You don't like it? He hates it. Hates it. Next idea. Recruit like 10 photographers.
Mm-hmm. Now you're talking.
To make sunlit posts on the same day. Mm-hmm. And photographers you respect, you pitch them on the fact that you love their work, whatever, you know, you like their Instagram stuff. And would they be willing to try sunlit, to have a sneak peek at the new version, to try it and be part of your launch day for promoting the app?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think that's a great idea. And that's actually more or less how Instagram was bootstrapped. You know, Instagram, they actually hired a community manager really early on as well. And I think part of that job, or someone related to that early team of just a few people, was to reach out to photographers and get them on the service. And that works. You know, of course, if you have the time to contact people. But related to that, too, is I do have... I think we have like a little over 100 people in the beta. So not a huge group, but that's enough people where you could kind of bootstrap it that way. And if those people love the app and want to, I mean, essentially help promote it, but also just use it, then that can kind of indirectly and directly help.
Yeah. I mean, it could be hard to get the quality you're looking for combined with the type of formatting that you're looking for or hoping for, combined with just simply getting people to actually go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is part of a wider, you know, taking this in a broader view, there's this whole aspect of marketing that occurs when you help to promote somebody else and their enthusiasm for that means that they in turn promote you. Yeah. And this is, you know, for example, if we were to have more podcast guests on our show, we would get more promotion for the show.
Right.
It's just like the mere act of like saying, hey, we respect you and we want to feature you on our show. People like that. And then they're enthused about sharing the show with more people. And, you know, this is a phenomenon that we could probably take more advantage of on our podcast, with our apps, etc. But, you know, it's like, it's the same idea as like, hey, well, if you wrote like customer profiles, you know, if you write customer profile and it's, you know, honest and paints one of your customers in a good light, there's a good chance they're going to share that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a whole realm of sort of like, I don't think it's shady at all, but it's just one of these things where it's like, if you do promote somebody else, they're liable to promote you back. It's it's kind of one of these human nature things.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think it's shady either. Cause like with the Micro Monday podcast we do, like every week we feature someone from the community, and the goal was never to hope that they linked back to us, right? The goal was to actually talk to someone about what they're doing and how they blog, because that's inspiring to other people. But yeah, there's this extra benefit that it helps spread the word. Yeah, that's good stuff. Good stuff. Thank you, Daniel. And thank you for the ideas. I wish I had more time to actually do all of them, but somewhere in there are some things that I think I can do and hopefully get the word out about this release.
And I'd just like to quickly add, remember, we've talked about this before too, but you always have a second chance to do marketing. So, you know, if you don't get to all of these ideas, if you don't get to one of these ideas, if you just have a regular dang old launch, you can keep the idea in the hopper. You can, a month from now, you can have like a 10 photographers use sunlit promotion. You can have like a, you know, spotlight on, or rather sunlight on, on so-and-so, how they use it.
Yeah.
I think it's a great idea in general to and it also helps humanize the service. You already have a very human service, but anything any of us can do to help shine a light on actual people solving actual needs is really good for, it's intrinsically good for marketing.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening to the show this week. Good talking to you, Daniel, and we will talk to you next week.
Sounds good. See you then.